Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So Verizon says it's going to charge customers a new $2 fee. Verizon customers freak out. Verizon backs off. But it's clear that for both sides, this wasn't really about $2 at all. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdal. Thanks for joining us for the Marketplace podcast on this Friday. It is the 30th of December, the day one of the biggest phone companies in America did a 180. It started yesterday when Verizon Wireless announced that it would start charging customers a fee to pay their bill, $2 if the payment was made over the phone or if it was a one-time payment online. No fee if customers set up recurring payments. Today, federal regulators said they were looking into it, and within hours, Verizon dropped the fee. In a moment, what's the big deal about $2? But first, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith tells us what Verizon was up to.
To look at why companies keep on pelting us with new and irritating fees, I thought I'd start with the industry that elevated the fee to an art form.
Airlines can think of fees that we mere mortals can't.
Aviation consultant Michael Boyd says fees bring in big money. Baggage charges alone are set to total nearly $3.5 billion this year. But what about all of the ill will it creates? Boyd says airlines would probably charge a fee for that, too, if they could figure out how.
There hasn't been any downside so far because people pay it. They're good little sheep. And if they keep on paying it, airlines will keep on charging it.
Generating cash isn't the only reason companies like fees, says Paul Grill. He tracks the payments industry for First Annapolis Consulting. He says fees are part of
a pricing strategy that we might call unbundling, where companies are looking to charge more discreetly for a product or service.
So, companies can charge competitive low rates, and then customers who do expensive things, like pay over the phone or get a bank statement in the mail, pay extra, which ends up encouraging customers to behave in ways that benefit the company. The one problem? Outrage. George Lowenstein teaches economics and psychology at Carnegie Mellon, but he says even if customers get angry and mean to switch banks or cell phone providers, most won't.
They procrastinate on their one-person boycott. And they'll end up paying by credit card and incurring the $2 fee. And after they do it a few times, they won't even be particularly bothered by it.
Lowenstein says Verizon should have stuck it out. In fact, for fees to actually work, he says, you have to keep on pointing them out to customers. Only then will they reach the outrage threshold and finally change the way they pay. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. For Marketplace.
Okay, so that's the company's side of the story. But what about the consumer? What is it about a $2 fee that is so offensive right now? Here's Marketplace's Eve Troe.
Verizon just had its Bank of America moment. When the financial giant backed down from a $5 debit card fee this year, it sent a message well beyond the financial industry, says David Butler at Consumers Union.
That these types of fees are going to attract more scrutiny from media, more attention from customers than they have in years. Customers are ready to speak out and look at their options and vote with their feet.
And ready to show up in your lobby singing angry Christmas songs. You behave as if you own us, they sang at a B of A Seattle branch. Jean Bliss at Customer Bliss says consumers flipped the script this year, and they were right to. When big companies are in survival mode, like they are now, customers have more power.
They're putting the pieces together so that they say, look, I have this value. I've been with you for a long time. Don't take me for granted.
Bliss says the internet acts like a megaphone for those individual hurt feelings. Customers tweet about a new fee or blog about tricky fine print, and soon the company's voice gets drowned in the outcry.
70 to 75% of a customer's buying decision is based on talking to other people, talking to colleagues, and reading reviews and reports on the internet.
And consulting with all those friends, real and virtual, will only give customers more courage to call up a phone company or bank or cable service and say, I'm just not that into you. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Now, a quick correction to a story we aired yesterday about the Chinese company Alibaba's interest in buying Yahoo. We misstated the role of Bain Capital in a tech deal involving another Chinese company. Bain and Huawei Technologies were joint bidders for 3Com back in 2008. National security concerns blocked that deal. On Wall Street today, stocks were down. For the year, though, flat as a pancake. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Well, it's been a quiet week in Washington, but today, a reminder of the economic roller coaster ride we've all taken this year. President Obama said he'll delay a request to increase the nation's debt limit by another $1.2 trillion to give Congress a chance to weigh in on the issue once lawmakers return to Washington. The debt ceiling debacle over the summer was, of course, just one of the big economic stories of 2011. And here to put the year in context for us are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and John Carney from CNBC. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Jeremy.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Lee, I want to start with you and let's talk about the good and the bad. And let's start with the bad so we can end with the good. What do you think was the story of 2011 that we'll look back on and say that really was not good for business?
You know, I would have to say it was sort of the dysfunction in Washington this year that just led to so much gridlock and protracted bickering, whether it was, I guess the pinnacle of that was the negotiations over the debt ceiling, which led to our credit being downgraded. But really, it was that. It was endless kind of 11th hour government shutdowns, whether it was stimulus spending or the current, you know, payroll tax, just wrangling and bickering and the inability to get anything done as our economic situation kind of just twisted in the wind. I think that was a serious, serious negative and cast a pall over the economy this year.
John, government dysfunction, the worst thing of the year. Do you agree?
I don't agree, actually. I think we discovered something wonderful when our credit got downgraded. It's that we don't need to live in fear of credit rating agencies anymore. What happened when we got downgraded? People bought bonds. Yeah. They bought U.S. treasuries. So what we discovered is that the United States government, because it controls its own currency, because it will never default, no matter what some, you know, pinhead at S&P or Moody's says, our treasuries are safe. The market behaves like they are safe and people buy them no matter how bad things get.
Okay, so if you see government dysfunction as a good thing, what was your worst pick for business story of 2011?
I think the worst thing that happened is that Europe completely melted down. I mean, they just were unable to get their act together to figure out what they needed to do to prevent the entire European Union, this multi-generational project, is crumbling before their eyes, and they can't figure out how to prevent it. It's amazing. It's very bad for business. It's bad for Americans. It's very bad for Europeans. It's bad for China. It threatens the entire global economy, and it's mostly because they refuse to back up their national government's debts. Unlike the United States, we back up our Federal Reserve, our central bank backs up our debt. It buys our debt when the interest rates go too high. They don't have a system where they can do that, and it's failing. They're crumbling.
Lee, do you agree with that? Because some people don't agree that the euro is crumbling. What do you think?
Well, I agree with John that the situation in Europe was definitely a huge negative. I mean, talk about protracted wrangling. It just seemed to be endless. And even though, you know, we do have this recent deal that the ECB put through, which will help the banks and hopefully in so doing also help the countries and their government debt. But it's definitely far from clear that that's going to be solved. As for the euro, I mean, you know, it's funny. There's polls starting to appear on the internet about whether you think the euro is going to collapse or not. I don't think it'll collapse because I just don't think that Europe could afford the just confidence fallout and just the social unrest and everything that would come from that. So I think every effort will be made to not have that happen.
All right. Well, while we have you here, let's get to the good here. Lee, best story of 2011 in business.
You know, you don't have to look too far for it. It's happening in Silicon Valley. I mean, from the way that the startups are getting funded out there to the way millionaires are being minted through these IPOs this year, to the real estate market in Palo Alto is soaring, going against every single trend in this country. And, you know, balsamic vinegar being sold at $40 a teaspoon. I mean, it's a completely different story out there right now. And I think that, you know, people here where I am in New York don't really realize that. It's just a completely different world. And, you know, there's a lot happening and there's a lot of hype, but there's also a lot of stuff happening.
Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and John Carney from CNBC. Thanks to both of you and have a happy new year.
Thanks to you, too.
Thank you. Happy new year.
If you scan the list of chief executive officers at America's biggest companies, you won't find many women. The latest Fortune 500 list includes just 16 female CEOs. But on Sunday, that number will go up when longtime IBM exec Virginia Romity becomes CEO of the world's second largest publicly traded technology company. So what's the word on the new CEO's vision for IBM? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
If Virginia Romity had just one word for you about the next big thing, it might sound a bit reminiscent of that famous scene from The Graduate.
Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
That is so 1960s. Just ask IBM's incoming chief what she's focusing on. Are you listening?
Analytics.
Yep, Virginia Romity sees a bright future for her company in analytics. I know, I had no idea what that is either, so I got Forrester research analyst Bobby Cameron on the line to help explain it.
The amount of information, the amount of data we have is exploding continuously, and people are learning how to turn that data into information that they can take action on.
The new IBM chief is staking the company's future on doing just that, developing ways to mine all that data and put it to productive use. She spoke like an evangelist at a recent conference about a panel discussion on this new way of doing business.
What these future leaders talked about was, could you build a culture of analytics in a company? And that doesn't mean reports and reporting. They meant, no, change the very fiber of what it is that you do. Let it permeate everything that you do.
Romity has been pushing that goal as a company vice president. She was a big supporter of IBM's TV game show stunt on Jeopardy this year that helped demonstrate the power of data mining.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Watson.
Turns out that was more than just a stunt. IBM has already sold Watson's technology to healthcare provider WellPoint to help doctors diagnose patients. Tech analyst Rob Enderle says it's a natural extension to IBM's focus on providing solutions to the business world.
Heavy on services, heavy on software, and then wrapping the hardware underneath to fix real-world problems.
Transportation systems could predict traffic jams, and water systems are being developed to instantly pinpoint costly leaks. For IBM's new CEO, those kinds of integrated systems are the future.
What does it mean to be systems thinkers? Our generation, that's an expectation, and that will be a requirement to build the systems that will govern this world.
Forrester's Bobby Cameron points out the new IBM chief has her own critical systems to worry about.
It's a huge corporation. And to try to move that huge body as if it were an integrated whole and yet let all the individual parts be as creative as they've historically been, that's one heck of a challenge.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Coming up, as the Margaret Thatcher movie hits theaters, what do people think of her in her hometown?
Dictator, that's what I call her. Dangerous woman.
You weren't a supporter?
No. Very unpopular woman in this town, I would say, on the whole.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street's roller coaster of a year ended amazingly close to where it all began. The Dow Jones Industrial Average wheezed its way to a 69-point loss today and finished the year at 12,217. The NASDAQ deleted 8 points, ending at 2,605. S&P 500 sliced away 5 points, capping the year at 1,257. Now, let's analyze that last number for a moment. To be exact, the S&P closed at 1,257.60, and it started the year at 1,257.62. Not since 1970 has the index ended a year so close to unchanged. McDonald's shares served up the biggest gain on the Dow for the year. The worst performer was Bank of America. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. U.S. financial markets are closed in observation of the new year. Shipping company FedEx hikes rates for ground and home delivery by almost 5%. UPS ground services will increase by roughly 5% as well. And the Rose Bowl kicks off in Pasadena, California. The Oregon Ducks will play against the Wisconsin Badgers. I'm Justin Ho.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdahl. And I agree with what Lee Gallagher said just a few moments ago. If I had to pick one bright spot for the U.S. economy in 2011, it would probably be the one about 350 miles up the California coast from where I am right now in Silicon Valley. Despite the tough economic headwinds, the tech industry continued to innovate, produce, and even add some employees. Here now to wrap up the year in tech for us is Marketplace's Steve Henn, who joins us from, where else, Silicon Valley. Hi, Steve.
Hey.
So let's start by talking about the biggest companies in the tech world, like Apple, HP, and Google.
Yeah, I think the big story for all three of those companies is changes at the top. All three have new CEOs. Obviously, with Steve Jobs passing, Tim Cook is now in charge.
Right.
You know, and he's going to face lots of challenges. He has to find a new salesperson. I mean, one of the huge assets that Jobs brought to the table was he could build a tremendous amount of excitement for Apple products. And he needs to convince the markets and consumers that Apple products will still amaze. But obviously, you know, Apple's not the only company that's going through leadership changes.
Right. What about Google? We've got a new CEO there, too, where Larry Page took over for Eric Schmidt.
Larry Page came in earlier this year with a mission. One was to make Google a player in social. You know, so they launched Google Plus. That's going pretty well. But the other was really to bring some focus to the entire company, to focus what Google does, make it easier to understand for consumers, but at the same time protect that spirit of innovation that allowed it to do things like build a self-driving car.
What about HP, Steve? I guess this would be probably considered the dinosaur of Silicon Valley at this point, but another change at the top at Hewlett-Packard.
Yeah, you know, HP is this iconic company here, but it had a terrible, terrible year. It started 2011 with a relatively new CEO, Leo Apotheker. Probably his biggest misstep was in July. He announced that HP, which is the largest personal computer maker on the planet, wanted to get out of that business.
Right.
And in weeks, he got fired. So now Meg Whitman, you know, the former CEO of eBay and Republican gubernatorial candidate in California who ran against Jerry Brown last year, is now in charge. She has a real turnaround battle in front of her. So we'll see how it goes.
Well, it wasn't just leadership changes in Silicon Valley that were the big story of this year. There were a lot of things happening that are going to affect all of us who use tech devices.
Yeah, you know, one of the biggest is the cloud. You know, the cloud's been around for a while. Apple launched iCloud this year. Other companies have been selling cloud computing for a while. And 2011 might not have been the year it broke through, but it definitely was the year it became more and more common in people's everyday lives. So, you know, the cloud's already had an enormous impact on business, but I think in the next year, you're going to see it try and take over your personal entertainment system.
How is that going to happen, Steve? How are we going to interact with the cloud next year?
Well, if you think about it, you may not own any DVDs, but with Netflix or Amazon Prime or instant streaming, you can access tens of thousands of films instantly online. Those films live in servers you don't own. That's the cloud. And you can share and stream any kind of data that way. Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, they're all interested in dominating your television set. They want to deliver your shows and your music and your movies into your home. You know, there's a huge advertising and subscription windfall there. It's sort of the pot of gold at the end of this rainbow. And the fight over who controls that is shaping up to be one of the biggest tech battles in 2012.
So maybe we'll have even more remote controls in the living room.
No, it's all going to be voice activated.
There you go. Marketplace's Steve Henn in Silicon Valley. Steve, thanks so much and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too.
Well, in case you thought Hollywood was going to wrap up the year without releasing a biopic about a powerful British leader, check your local movie theater listings for today's opener, The Iron Lady. It's about former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, played by Meryl Streep. The movie has gotten mixed reviews, and so has the Iron Lady herself, more than 20 years after leaving office. In the UK, they're still arguing about the economic changes that Margaret Thatcher brought. We sent our London correspondent, Stephen Beard, to Thatcher's hometown of Grantham in the British Midlands to see how people feel about her now.
As a girl, Margaret Thatcher lived above this modest shop in Grantham. It was her father's grocery store. These days, it's a clinic for alternative medicine. Receptionist Lorraine takes visitors upstairs to show them the private quarters.
This is her bedroom.
So this is where the future Prime Minister of England had her bedroom?
I guess so, yeah.
She looked out of that window.
yeah, she did.
This is not a shrine. In fact, there's nothing in this small, dingy room to connect it with the former, now famous, inhabitant Margaret Thatcher, local Conservative politician Ray Wootton.
All you will see is a small rectangular plaque above the shop where Mrs. Thatcher lived. Apart from that, there's nothing at all in Grantham to say that she was from here.
He's called for a statue of Grantham's most famous daughter. He wants it to be erected alongside an existing statue of the town's most famous son, the man who discovered gravity, Isaac Newton. Wootton says Thatcher allowed people to defy gravity and rise above their humble origins.
She made Britain a fairer place to live in, a country where, regardless of your background, you can actually get on and have opportunities to succeed in life.
Thatcher shook up the British economy, curbed labour union power and pushed the free market. She bulldozed her way through all opposition, earning herself some enemies back here in her industrial hometown.
Dictator, that's what I call her. Dangerous woman.
You weren't a supporter?
No. Very unpopular woman in this town, I would say, on the whole.
I'd rather Grantham was well known for Isaac Newton than for Margaret Thatcher. Her economic policy, as is shown now, was totally wrong.
That's Ursula Brown. She believes that Thatcher ruined the British economy because she withdrew state aid from manufacturing while promoting financial services.
All the manufacturing industry has been much reduced, and the banking in financial services are... It's terrible what they're doing.
Thatcher tried to cut the size of the state. She sold off many state-owned assets, like water and power companies, claiming their services would be delivered more efficiently in the private sector. They're certainly more expensive now, says local Labour councillor Ian Selby.
We've got electricity bills going up, absolutely astronomical increases, 20-30% increases in some of these.
And you blame that on Margaret Thatcher?
Well, it was her that sold off these utilities.
Of course, Margaret Thatcher does have her supporters, like Hilda Newbury.
No, I think she was good for Britain. She stood up to the unions when, I can remember the days when we had blackouts with the electricity being cut off and things like that. She stopped all that.
She was a very controversial figure, though, wasn't she?
She was a woman. she wouldn't stand any nonsense.
But that apparently did not endear her to most people here. A local paper asked its readers what they would like to see displayed at a prominent site in the town. A bronze statue of Margaret Thatcher or an antique steamroller. 85% voted for the steamroller. In Grantham, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Well, as we wrap up Marketplace for 2011, we wanted to bring you some of the business stories that you may have missed. So we've got two people who always manage to find stories that the rest of us can't. You might know them from a segment we call Small Talk. I'm talking about our friends Brendan Francis Noonan and Rico Galliano. They're the hosts of APM's The Dinner Party, and they've come prepared with some of their favorite offbeat stories of the year. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Brendan, first to you.
That's right. We're the basement dwellers of the news world. And here are some of the stories we found. One of our favorites was a paint company in Canada, CIL Paints, launched a Paint Colors for Men collection in November. Now, most of their paint's original names were geared towards women, and they were designed to kind of create an emotional connection. So this was an effort to create more interest among male consumers.
Right, for say, for their man cave, maybe to paint their man cave.
That's right, and to garner free publicity, which they're now receiving.
Still,
again,
even to this day.
So, for example, some of the colors, they changed butterscotch, sounds like a nice color. Mm. They changed that to beer time, which is considered, quote,
it's manly.
Yeah, it sure is.
Peacock's plume. The male version is called Pimping the Trans Am.
Yeah. Can't you just visualize that?
What color is it, by the way?
It's a turquoise, I think, is the actual original color.
Maybe instead of changing the name, they might change the color of the paint.
That's
anyway, that's just my thoughts. I'm not in the paint business. Rico, what about you? What stories do you have for us?
This is an item that appeared on a lot of tech blogs earlier this year. I don't think this thing was ever actually built, but it was a prototype alarm clock. And the idea was that before you went to bed at night, you would put paper money, like a
dollar bill.
Sure, or a $1,000 bill if you were part of the 1%. Right. Correct. In the morning, the alarm would go off, and then the clock would slowly start shredding the money until you were perhaps motivated to wake the heck up. And I think that
would probably
work.
I think.
I'm surprised that nobody's actually made this thing yet. There was a ton of buzz about it, but it still seems not to exist.
Okay, so an alarm clock that eats your money. Paint that is just for men. What else have we got?
Well, we have another kind of sleep-related story. Yeah. Crowne Plaza, the international hotel chain, earlier this year introduced snore patrols. And these are snore monitors who roam the hallways listening for people snoring too loudly, and then they knock on the door and they kind of ask them to stop snoring.
Talk about your awesome part-time jobs, right?
Yeah, is this just to increase the level of employment in the country?
That's right. It's been a boon for people with library science degrees. It's also a great opportunity for creeps who want to roam around
at
listening.
Last. Also, I mean, like you just know that at some point they're going to start charging you to stay in the sort of quiet zone area of the hotel, which to me is like paying to have wings on the plane. Isn't that why
that's true.
We go to a hotel?
Brendan Francis Noonan and Rico Galliano are the hosts of APM's culture show, The Dinner Party. You can hear more from them at dinnerpartydownload.org. Guys, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow lopped off 69 points, a little more than 0.5%. The NASDAQ carved away 8 points, 1/3 of 1%. And the S&P 500 slipped 5 points, 0.4% to end the year right where it started. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Next time on this show, the caucuses in Iowa may mean just as much for the state as they do for the candidates.
It provides a lot of exposure for the state of Iowa, a lot of media coverage of the state of Iowa. To a certain degree, it covers our issues.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. From all of us at Marketplace, have a safe and happy new year. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.